76-year-old Sven-Goran Eriksson played football in his native Sweden before moving into management. He had great success with Swedish, Portuguese and other league clubs, winning 18 titles in all. Then in 2001, he was catapulted to fame when he was appointed to the role of England football manager, the first foreigner to get the coveted job. During his time with England, he brought them from 17th place in the world rankings to 5th place when he departed in 2006. Did that satisfy them? Of course it didn't. Anyway, Sven made a lot of headlines back then, and they weren't confined to the sports section. At the time, he was in a relationship with the Italian lawyer Nancy Dell'Olio, which was rocked to the core when the papers exposed his affairs with the Swedish broadcaster Ulrika Johnson and Football Association Secretary Faria Alam. In January, Sven revealed to the world that he had been given a terminal diagnosis and had just 1 year to live. Today, Primetime released their documentary called Sven, which takes us on a journey through the highs and lows of his eventful life. He now lives back in Sweden, and the documentary begins with Sven. He takes us on a tour of his man cave and shows off the famous people he has met in his life.
Come on. All my life, football was my love. Football, 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 always. This is gentleman's room. A lot of photos. Nelson Mandela, that was great. The Pope from Poland, free kick, goal. Beautiful memories. But I don't know, I can't put it on the walls. They are too big and too many.
That's a clip from Sven, which is on Prime Video. And RT's sports presenter, Dara Maloney, has watched Sven for us.
I have.
Dara, you're immersed in football. Can you recall 2001 when he was appointed?
Yes, I can. Because England had, I think Kevin Keegan was the previous manager, and they were kind of in trouble. They were in bother. And it was a huge moment because he was England's first foreign football manager. And as he says himself in the documentary, if you don't win the World Cup or a major championship, as Gareth Southgate found out a few months ago, you're a failure as the England manager. So he, you know, he had been, we knew from, I think he coached in Italy for 13 years. When I first heard of him was 1982. And he took a part-time team called IFK Gothenburg to win. It would now be called the Europa League. It was the UEFA Cup. It was just like a fairy tale, a miracle. It shouldn't have happened. It certainly wouldn't happen these days to take a part-time team to beat all these professional teams. So he did have a profile of sorts. And I suppose I came at this documentary initially from the football point of view. You know, knowing him, I would have commentated and been at England matches. That some of them, they're in the documentary, the World Cup quarterfinal in 2002, where they lost to Brazil. They lost to Portugal in back-to-back tournaments in 04 and 06. Both went out on penalties. And, you know, he's a fascinating character. You come at it from the football point of view, but you can't kind of unlink the football from all the affairs. And a lot of people won't watch this because they won't like his morals or lack of morals and the judgments that he made. With the documentary itself, like it's, I don't know, you watched it. It's a kind of an emotional roller coaster.
There were
a few tears.
And he's a very cool customer,
isn't he? Oh, always. And it's funny, there's an article from The Guardian, again, it was part of the press tour for this, where he does a lovely one-on-one interview with this English journalist. And they describe him as he was a very calm, always beautifully turned out on the touchline with, you know, pressed shirts and lovely suits and not a hair out of place. He has that, I call it a five head, you know, with it's not a forehead. It's kind of where he was losing his hair at the front. He took the England job at 52 years of age, but they called him, you know, he's so calm. And then they found out he was a secret Casanova. And the article says, well, he wasn't so secret at all, because everybody found out about these affairs. He was involved in the phone hacking scandal in the noughties. You know, the tabloids in England were at their zenith. They were at their zenith. They were at their peak. And he found out later that his phone was hacked for years. And that's how all this information came out into the public domain.
Now, you were talking about his success as a football manager. I mean, it was a fairy tale. Mm. Like he had this dream that he wanted to make it big in football. And he was in a small little, as you say, part amateur club in Sweden. So that achievement was extraordinary.
It was huge. I think he told his friends, he used to play football. He retired at the age of 27. was the coach of that Gothenburg team at the age of 30. He told his friends when he was a teenager, he said, I'm going to be famous. And he's from this little town called Vormland. It's not, well, 5,000 people. And like, he's the most famous thing, an infamous thing to come out of that place. And, you know, as you say, where the documentary starts, he's gone home to die. All the globetrotting that he did, he coached in Mexico, he coached in Ivory Coast. He coached, obviously, I mentioned about Portugal with Benfica and in Italy and then the England job. And he's gone home to die.
Could you describe how we see him in Sweden and what's the setup now in his life?
Well, he's back living a beautiful house on the side of a lake. And he tells you in the documentary, this lake, I'm going to have my ashes poured into the lake. And he's made all these plans. You meet his family, his son and his daughter. And it's a nice thing, actually. He has, because the children, he was divorced when the children were very young.
And this would be his first
wife. His first wife, yes. Now, he was never married to that lady, Nancy, you spoke about. It was a relationship, but he wasn't married to her. And he has kind of he got back in touch with his daughter, having been away from her for a long time. And his son is there. He's a lovely man. He has a partner now, a lady he met when he was coaching in Mexico, the national team out there. He's been with her for 16 years and she's interviewed on the documentary. Everybody's on it. Nancy is on it. Faria Alam, who you mentioned, the FA secretary, who he had an affair with in 2004. She's on it. And, you know, it's all there. There's no editorial control from Sven. This is warts and all. Everything is there. And you just, you know, you're taken through this story.
Yes. Now Ulrika isn't there. Ulrika Johnson.
True.
And
yes.
she's the first person. So he brought this firebrand, Nancy Deulovio, with him to Britain.
Yeah.
And she was fodder for the tabloids, but she also liked pushing herself.
Yeah, of course. Well, look, you know, the profile, like Nancy was a lawyer that liked the limelight. Sven didn't like it. There's an editor from the News of the World who's featured quite heavily during the programme, and he goes through, you know, how the phone hacking stuff and how they found out this information. And he didn't know. He's not from a sports background, so he didn't know who Sven was when he got the job in 2001. And he goes to the press conference and they try and kind of grill him. And again, there was resistance, as I mentioned, from the English journalists having a foreign manager. You know, they didn't like this at all. We invented the game and what are you doing bringing one of these guys in here? It was that kind of thing. And they were saying, can you name any of the left backs at such and such a team? And of course, he couldn't. But what the journalist guy from the News of the World says is kind of a funny story. He said, you know, we saw him, you know, come out of a restaurant and all the paparazzi were outside taking photographs. And, you know, he's very well dressed, but kind of looks a bit awkward and geeky. And then all of a sudden, this supermodel comes out behind him, this lady, Nancy Deulovio. And they're kind of going, hang on a minute, what's that about? And that started their obsession with him. And I think, again, that's why the kids were with their mother, his first wife, because they couldn't be near this limelight.
Let's listen to another clip, because they do get into the affairs and they talk about Ulrika Johnson. She's not in it. And Nancy talks about her disappointment or disgust with Sven. But it's really this Faria Alma who really opens up her heart and shows how damaged she was by it all. But this is how she met him.
April 2003. I joined the FA as executive assistant to David Davis. I just thought, wow, I've got this amazing job. It was very masculine. I was something new and shiny. I remember Sven came to my desk. He said, good morning. You must be Faria. And he shook my hand. And he just went, wow, like that, something like that. And it fascinated me, this man that was so powerful, but he didn't have the mindset of a super rich man. He talked to me about poetry, he talked to me about art. He was saying how he did yoga and things like that. And I just fell in love with him, I guess. And that lit the fuse for what was to explode.
You see, Dara, it was the arts worked, not sport.
Yeah. Well, it's like, again, I suppose this is the thing I mentioned about why some people won't watch this, because of, you know, the lives that he ruined along the way. And that young lady, she had to resign from the Football Association. He didn't face any disciplinary action. And she had to resign because she knew she couldn't get a job anywhere else. She then, under Sven's advice, he advised her to sell her story. So she went on a television programme in the UK and... she was torn apart. It wasn't sympathetic to her at all. And now she lives in Seattle in the United States.
And he's asked about these affairs. Mm. How did you think he responded? Did you think of the way he responded?
I don't know. I suppose he kind of, like, he didn't apologise. He didn't handle that bit very well. I don't know if he thought that through enough. Like, he kept saying, "Oh well, I didn't murder anybody." And you're kind of going, "Hang on a minute," you know. So. That was a part that he got quite defensive with. You could see that he was not comfortable asking those questions, answering those questions, should I say.
Yes, I felt he was a bit dismissive of both Faria and Nancy. There was a little laugh in his voice, which was kind of... Yeah. Cruel, I know.
Like, but this is, as I say, this is why there are parts of this, you know, there are very emotional parts, and there are parts of that are really uncomfortable and leave you kind of feeling quite hollow after it. Because, you know, the as I said, that lady, Faria and Nancy, like, they were, Nancy and Sven were together for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And she still lives in Italy and did, you know, she was very open and honest in the interview, as was Faria as well, you know.
Now, two people who do love and admire him are David Beckham and Wayne Rooney. So they're key linchpins in this, aren't they?
Huge, they are. So, like, David Beckham, he's still friendly with Sven now. He's in touch with him all the time, even more so since he had his diagnosis, or since it became public. I think he was diagnosed early in 2023, which is when they started making this documentary. It took him 6 months to get to grips with what was happening, and then to actually announce it in January and to tell everybody that he would be dead by the end of the year. Beckham and himself very close. Rooney and himself really close as well. And there's a story. And again, this is the contradictions with him, you know, the disasters in his private life, and the players absolutely idolised him. Roberto Mancini, former Italy head coach, former Man City coach, he's in it too. But Rooney's in it. And Sven says about he treated the players like they were his other children. And he said, "I never shouted at them. I'm not going to shout at my children. So I'm not going to shout at these players. They want to learn and they need to be nurtured and all that sort of thing." But in 2006, after this World Cup quarterfinal defeat to Portugal on penalties, Wayne Rooney had been sent off, and Rooney was just, like, Sven talks about him as this incredible talent, which he was, and Rooney was 19 years of age, and Sven already knew that he was going to be leaving the England job after the tournament anyway. So he gives his final press conference the morning after they lose, and again, this is in the documentary, and he sits there and he says, you know, he says, "Do not kill Wayne Rooney." And Rooney tells this story and starts to cry in the documentary. He says, "Do not kill Wayne Rooney. Kill me," Sven says, "kill me, because you don't need me, but England need Rooney for years to come." And it's a very emotional bit with Rooney when he tells that story, you know. But the players did like him, yeah.
Derry, his career goes a bit bonkers, doesn't it?
It does.
After he leaves England. There's this whole thing with Notts County and who are going to have millions and billions of funding, which all just falls away like grains of sand, doesn't it?
And then in the middle of his England tenure, he gets done by the fake Sheikh. It's a kind of a sting operation where he's caught and recorded telling this fictional investor from the Far East that he's going to buy Aston Villa. Sven will work for him for £5 million a year and David Beckham will sign. Now, he didn't get fired over that by the English FA, you know, but it was later on when he was told, "Look, you're out of here," they let him stay on for 6 months or whatever. But that was a huge scandal. But the Notts County thing, he managed Man City for a year, and the owner of Man City, let's just say his practices back in his home country were not what you would like your people to be treated by, and how you would like them to be treated. So Notts County, he took over a team at the foot of, I think, the second or third tier in England, and there's an investor there supposedly who's going to plough millions into it, and he signs, who does he get? Sol Campbell, and he gets a lot of high profile players. Kasper Schmeichel, who's Peter's son, the ex-Man United and Man City goalkeeper, and he's there, and he said the first sign he knew something was wrong was when they didn't didn't pay the milk bill. So he ends up in North Korea trying to negotiate a mineral deal and to get North Korea a better draw on the World Cup and all this crazy stuff. So I suppose there's one line, Kay, about him. There's several words that I'd write down about him and all the contradictions, but there's a line in it, I think, is it Henry Winter or somebody else says, that the respected football journalist says, he never learned from his mistakes. And Sven himself says he was naive, he was gullible. I think an accountant he had ran off with or lost 10 million quid on him, bad investments. He brought him to court, but he didn't want to get the money back. He just wanted an apology. Like, there are all these weird and strange kind of parts of his personality.
But what an interesting life.
Oh, so look, and he says himself a fairy tale with a lot of nightmares thrown in.
Darren Maloney, thank you so much for reviewing Sven for us. And Sven is released on Prime Video today. Theatre Lovett returned to the stage this September with an exciting new family show that features a blood-loving character that helps a talented maestro see the realities of how life should really be conducted. The Maestro and the Mosquita is a new work by award-winning writer and director for screen and stage Carmel Winters, brought together with an original full score by Academy Award-winning composer Stephen Warbeck. The show is making its debut at the Dublin Fringe Festival and makes its world premiere at the Project Arts Centre from the 12th to the 15th of September. I'm delighted to be joined by Carmel Winters and Stephen Warbeck from our Cork studio. Carmel, you're very welcome on Arena. Perhaps you might tell us first about The Maestro and the Mosquita. It's a non-verbal show for all the family.
Thanks, Kay. It's a comedy musical. And it's a bit of a Laurel and Hardy or a Tom and Jerry show, in the sense that it features these two classical enemies, the maestro and the mosquita. The maestro is a very accomplished conductor. In late life, he has found himself in a situation where really he's been a bit defeated by life and disappointed in life, and he blames it all on the character of the Mosquita. And what we see in the play is their journey together through from the maestro's infancy through to the end of his life, and we get a chance to see them unravel this difficult relationship and really heal it and become, as we say, that little monster ultimately becomes the maestro's very best friend.
Now, as you say, it's a non-verbal show, and I was reading it today, which really kind of threw me, because I thought, I'm reading this and I can picture it all in my mind. So you're writing a whole series, is it, of stage directions, would that be right? And physical storytelling? I've never seen a script like it. Could you just describe how you write that kind of non-verbal script?
Well, I think I kind of become... first of all playwriting for me is something that really starts in my body. And then this one, I felt like I was writing music, even though I'm not. But I was so aware of the space in between every gesture I described. And I was very aware of the blank space on the page and the words I wrote to kind of suggest the action, that the rhythm of the words suggested the rhythm of the action. And I suppose I was reliant on that rhythm to a great extent, Kay. So I'm delighted to hear that you had images in your mind. I am describing the images and the actions, but I'm also suggesting the beat of it and the life of it and the heart of it.
Yes, because, and it doesn't come like images of cartoons. It's more like images of black and white movies like Chaplin or Laurel and Hardy. Is that what you were going for, or Jacques Tati maybe?
Yeah, I mean, my favourite pair to watch growing up were Laurel and Hardy, who were also my father's favourite. And my father was quite deaf. So when I was watching with my father, I had the double pleasure of really being inside how he responded to the world and received the world. And usually that was a little bit removed, because his deafness in a hearing family and in a hearing culture, he didn't belong to deaf culture. So I had the intimacy of seeing his enjoyment of something that was communicated visually. Now, there was the score I had as well, But in a way, you'll see the score in the rate of the camera. The camera frame would have been hand cranked. So there is a visual rhythm that equates to the score. And Laurel and Hardy were just masters of the music, of movement, of embodiment.
Stephen, I believe you and Carmel are old friends and collaborators in the past. How does your relationship, your artistic relationship, work?
Well, I like to think it works very well. I mean, we've known each other for quite a few years. Carmel phoned me up and said, do you want to come over to Dublin and meet and talk about a film she made called Float Like a Butterfly? So I went over and walked up several flights of stairs to a very small cutting room. And Carmel said, let's go in the next room. So we went in the next room and both looked out of the window and just talked for an hour and a half. And I thought, oh, yes, I definitely want to work with this person. And we didn't particularly talk about the film, but it's one of those things when you've got a collaborator and you feel, oh, yes, we're on the same imaginative wavelength. I mean, we may not be, but it feels as though we are.
And Float Like a Butterfly was Carmel's film about a young female boxer.
Exactly, yes.
And Stephen, then, what do you like to do as a composer? Do you like to work in collaboration from a very early stage of the project?
That's my favourite way of working, definitely. I mean, if it's a film, for example, I like to be feeding ideas to and fro with the director right from the early part of the editing process, or even before filming takes place. In the case of our work on this, Carmel and I looked at this script and did a small workshop in Dublin probably 4 years ago. So I've been aware of it and thinking about it for a long time. And then to be flung into the room with the fantastic Theatre Lovett, where straight away you're playing and you're playing around with the ideas in the script and improvising with a fantastically creative team. It's very stimulating, and the ideas bouncing to and fro between the musician and the performer.
Now, we're going to play some of the music you created for this, Stephen. It's the early years. Will you just give us the scenario and how you thought about creating this piece?
Well, I think, as Carmel said a few minutes ago, we see his early years, we see him growing from a child, we see him being aware of the world and the sounds around him and relating them to his musical imagination. And little by little, he absorbs music and music becomes part of him. And we wanted at one point in the show to be in a position to say he's at one with the world and he's at one with his creativity. And I attempted to write a piece of music which expressed a love for music and his peace and repetition, but oneness with that art.
Let's listen now. Yes, we can feel the maestro enraptured in his art there in that extract from The Maestro and the Mosquita, composed by Stephen Warbeck and written by Carmel Winters. Carmel, obviously, who plays the maestro is very important because he brings that physical language to what you've written and to the wonderful music Stephen has composed. And you have Louis Lovett from the wonderful theatre company, Theatre Lovett.
I mean, Louis is an exceptional artist. He's one of a kind. I've lately begun thinking of him as Walt Disney Studio live in one man on stage. I mean, he's utterly extraordinary in his inventiveness. And the play, in fact, like, I won't be able to claim credit. This is my play. It is an incredibly rich collaboration between all four of us, me, Stephen, Murn, Louis. But really, it's an opportunity for me to provoke an actor into the fullness of their capacity to delight an audience with doing things you think, is that possible? He did it. I mean, I do think we go to the theatre for the art of the performer. And everything I do is in service to that in theatre, because the art, the performer is the emotional conduit with the audience. And Louis, he's really virtuoso. I mean, he can conjure and invent in the moment to a degree that if you saw the same show, if you saw every single performance, you would not see the same performance twice. So a part of the imagining of this, I was imagining if I had Louis Lovett, and what would I create for him?
And Stephen, are you equally impressed by Louis?
I'm also impressed by him as a musical imagination, because right from the beginning, we'd be improvising music in the room together. So the music, a lot of it comes from an improvised thing in the room where we'd end up singing together, or I'd be playing the piano and he'd be singing. And we made stuff up in the moment in a really organic way, which is in the show. I mean, it's fine-tuned and changed and all the rest of it. It's kind of evolved. But it's the creativity seemed to be across the board on so many levels, and his vocal range is a delight, very amusing, very impressive, and at times extremely emotional and powerful. So it's just endless. It's endlessly inventive and joyful as a process. And also we're both looking forward to working with the RTE Concert Orchestra in a gala performance in Dublin at some point soon. So if you can set the orchestra aside for a live performance, that would be very nice.
I'll put in the word.
Thank you.
Stephen Warbeck and Carmel Winters, it sounds like a really exciting and innovative show. Thank you so much for talking to us. The Maestro and the Mosquito, you can get more information on that from fringefest.com or at loveittheatre.com. Time to take a look at the latest album releases, and today we're looking at Fontaines DC's fourth album, Romance, produced by the Arctic Monkeys' go-to producer James Ford, and the album marks a new departure for the band in both sound and lyricism. Sabrina Carpenter's single Espresso was widely hailed as the song of the summer, with follow-up hits Please 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 hot on its heels. This will be the sixth studio album from the Disney alumni, who has truly made her mark on the pop world. Finally, he's known for being part of the rock band The Nation, The National, and is the current artist in residence at the National Concert Hall, Bryce Dresner. His album, released via Sony Classical, will be the last up for review this evening. Joining me in studio to discuss is John Marr and Kellyanne Byrne. First up is Fontaines DC and their highly anticipated fourth album. Let's take a listen to Romance, which is the title track. There, that's Romance, the title track from Fontaines DC, the fourth album. John, we spoke to Sinead Nivorda last night about their back catalogue and just talked about how anticipated this album is.
Absolutely. They're a band that have barely put a foot wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, those first three albums are superb. The first one, Doggerel in particular, really excited people, critics as well. Grian Chatton, frontman, his solo album last year also got glowing reviews. But I think what really excited people this time was the lead single Starburster, which indicated a significant change of direction, a change of look. It's an entirely different song to what they've done before, and it kind of signposted the fact that Romance is a very different album to what they've done before. Yeah.
Absolutely.
You say, I think, that you think this is a very expansive album, mm-hmm. a bit like John saying, it's just building, both in Chatton's delivery of the song and then in musically from the band.
Yeah, there's so many things about this record that are different. Like, as John said, I mean, the amount of genres, you've got like 90s trip hop. I felt like Massive Attack, Stereo MCs, people like Tricky on Starburster. And then you've also got like 90s grunge, you've got a whole shoegaze thing going on. It just sounds so beautiful. But I also feel that Green is using his voice in a whole new way. And I read something where he said he wasn't able to listen to himself before, and he's got to a stage now where he's really comfortable. And I think that really comes across in the delivery. There's a real sensualness to the way that he's singing, a kind of a breathiness as well. And I absolutely loved that on this record.
Yes, in Starburst, he makes use of that breath, doesn't he?
The inhales were, that reflected a panic attack that he had in London. And so it punctuates the whole record, you know, the... which we've all had on at some stage, so we can all relate to it.
Yeah, so effective, isn't it? I think The Modern World is one you picked out, John.
Yeah, it's an absolutely beautiful song. It's epic in scope. As Kellyanne says, you know, his voice is... there's a softness to his singing that really appeals. It's one of a number of fantastic songs here. You know, Favourite, which closes the album, is incredibly beautiful. It's easily my most played song of the year. It came out the second single 2 months ago, and it's probably the most nostalgic thing on this album, and perhaps the song that's most redolent of Fontaine's DC. But the beautiful thing about this album is that it is eclectic, incredibly eclectic. And it's, you know, there's very few tracks here that I would go, maybe they could have done something different here. They've really tried to do something different, which is remarkable for a band that have been together about 7 years, and they're thinking, right, let's reinvent the wheel a little bit for us. Yeah. Let's go out of our comfort zones. And I think when it's laudable for any act to do that, but when they do it as superbly as they do here, well, it's just wonderful.
Yes, and it's not easy when you're on the road a lot to do that, is it?
They have to be, like, they're the hardest working band in show business in under 5 years, I think it is. As John said, 4 records, then you've got Green's Chaos for the Fly, which was an unbelievable album. You know, I have so much admiration for them because they work so hard, and I feel like they're not in it for the fame. They're in it to push boundaries and make people think and push themselves, you know. It's a phenomenal record.
Okay. Well, let's listen to The Modern World and come back and chat some more.
I feel alive in the city.
That's The Modern World from Fontaine's DC's Romance. You love that song, Kellyanne.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I just said to John, my hairs are standing on end. I just love it. This record for me was the best when I listened to the album. And I said to John earlier, it almost had a bit of a, you know, Blur's Universal feel for me. I think the harmonies on this are incredible. Like going back to like God Only Knows by the Beach Boys. But I love the record. He said it's kind of influenced by time he spent in LA, where the vastness and the loneliness of it all, there was a certain beauty to that. And it's a bit of an homage to Lana Del Rey, I believe. But I think it's one of the best songs I've ever written.
And what else is he writing about or referencing, John?
Well, the title, Romance, is quite apt because these are essentially our love songs. You know, there's a song about where he talks about the city that you dislike and the city I love. And he's you know, he's been engaged for several years and lives in London now. And I assume that much of this is derived from his own personal life. There's far less of the... There are very few references, in fact, to Ireland on this album. The previous album, Skinty Fia, had political moments. There was a great line about the gall of Fine Gael and the fail of Fianna Fáil. Nothing like that here. It's more kind of universal, but with kind of intimate themes as well, and certainly based on love and contentment in a way. Mm. I have to say, much credit for this album should go to James Ford, the producer. He is Arctic Monkeys' go-to producer and has been for years, and helped that band change their sound dramatically. Fontaine's DC were on the road with Arctic Monkeys for a lot of last year, and they became quite close. Dan Carey, their previous producer, had really worked wonders in terms of that kind of garage sound that made Fontaine's name. But I think this is a marriage that's worked beautifully. Yeah. He's helped make them a little bit more adventurous. And I mean, the beautiful thing about this is it kind of, it makes you wonder where they're going to go next. Because if this kind of experimentation works so beautifully, like, the world is their oyster, it really is.
Absolutely.
So stars out of 5 for Romance from Fontaine's DC from you, Kellyanne.
It's 5 for me. I think it's their best work to date.
Well, after all you said, I'd be
disappointed if you didn't. What about you, John?
It's one of the easiest 5 stars I've ever had to give in here.
Yeah. Oh, outstanding. Excellent.
Okay, let's see how Bryce Dressner gets on. Solos is his new album. John, can you introduce us to this? He's known as a singer with the National, but this is a big new deal for him.
Yeah, it's almost hard to encapsulate the extraordinary CV this man has in a short paragraph. I mean, he is a multi-instrumentalist with the National. His twin brother Aaron is in that band as well. He has also worked with the aforementioned Taylor Swift. He regularly does film soundtracks. He has curated multiple festivals around the world, including Songs from a Safe Harbour in Cork.
Killian Murphy.
And he's worked with orchestras globally. He has feet in both the rock and classical worlds. And this album is very much in the classical world. Yeah.
So let's play one of the tracks, but you'll have to explain them. Maybe you would do it, Kellyanne. We'll play...
Are you playing
Yes, let's
or
play
on
that. Yeah, no, let's play Tusala.
Yeah, so I was reading about
this
track.
So he composes.
He composes. This album is called Solos, and it's works from both his classical and soundtrack worlds. This particular track was inspired by a town just outside Helsinki, where he was playing at a festival. It was known for artists going there in the 19th and 20th century. It has really unique architecture, and he was really inspired by the landscape, and that's where he wrote this track. It's 11 minutes 22 seconds, and it's so powerful.
And it's Anastasia Kobekina is the cellist.
A Russian cellist,
yeah. Yes. Exactly.
So Bryce Dessner of the Nationals, his composition for his solo album, and Anastasia Kobekina is the cellist there. Kellyanne, he's always been into classical music.
Yeah, I watched an interview with him. He started out playing the flute, actually, and then he said in his teenage years he got really into classical music, and then he perfected the classical guitar. What I love about him is that he said this thing where he loves being in the rock world too, because there can be a tendency as a classical composer to disappear up your own bum. Something like that he said. And he said, you know, it's great to have a foot in both worlds. And I think in a way he's made it a bit more accessible. Like myself and John were talking earlier, I'm no expert on classical music at all, but I found this album absolutely outstanding. I listened to it after Electric Picnic, and it was it was the most soothing record ever.
And is it filmic music, would you say? Yeah. Film music, or is it a bit...
I think it is to a degree, but I think it's very minimal too. I mean, he has worked with Steve Reich in the past, who is a godfather of minimalism, and there are some beautiful moments here that just sort of don't demand too much of the listener, but there's a lot going on. Very interesting work from the percussionist Colin Curry. A track called Trompe Miniature.
Oh, I love that.
Absolutely beautiful. Yeah. And the Finnish violinist Pekka Kuusisto, Ornament and Crime, just really delicate but gorgeously arranged and crafted tracks.
And were you surprised by this, or did you always know that
Not really. I mean, I've always been really intrigued by all 5 members of the National have so many extracurricular projects going on. Like, they're such an interesting band in their own right, but each of them goes on these fascinating tangents, and of all members he has been most intrigued by the possibilities of classical music. Aaron tends to be I suppose more producer extraordinaire now. Like, they worked, the Cyrano soundtrack from a few years ago was quite beautiful, and they worked on that.
And The Revenant was
The Revenant as well. I mean, you look on IMDb, there's a lot of credits here, and that's exciting. They're not just stuck with being in a 5-piece rock band.
And do you think people who love the 5-piece rock band would be open to this?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think they definitely will. There's so much there. Like, there's another song called On a Wire, which
featured...
Oh my God, like, that just blew me away. I definitely think so.